Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama swept into the White House 2 years ago, victorious as the inspirational, transformational figure out to change the world and break the cycle of venomous division in this country. He can hardly be accused of not taking the job seriously. But the road has been tough and the transformation elusive. Now his party's taken a drubbing at the polls, and even Obama supporters say they want, need something more from this president. But what? He's got a lot on the line. So does the country. This hour on Point, President Barack Obama at the midterm. We will hear in a moment from William Galston, a former Clinton staffer who's been analyzing the Obama presidency. But first, joining me from London, just in there from the U.S., is Roger Cohen, columnist for the New York Times. He's written several columns recently about the president and the American mood. His November 1st column was headlined, "Get Bold, Barack." Roger Cohen, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
We value your fresh ears and eyes. You've been back on the American scene as we came up to these midterm elections and right on through them. Share some of with us of what you were hearing and seeing about this sitting president, Barack Obama.
Well, it's a pretty astonishing turnabout when you think about the enormous optimism that accompanied his election and which I shared. And maybe there's a giant case of projection here, Tom. I mean, maybe we saw in this guy somebody who could reaffirm American possibility, bring us all together, and we were just a little deluded about his lack of experience, perhaps not asking enough about what his real convictions are. In any event, it's clear that the Tea Party has filled all the political space that was occupied just 2 years ago by President Obama. And I guess everyone's just struggling with a sense of disappointment, partly in him and maybe in my own case, partly in myself for having been so starry-eyed.
We've heard a lot of the Tea Party criticism. That's been exceedingly loud and right in the president's face. But you were hanging out in friendlier quarters to this president and heard levels of disappointment or hope for something more even there. Like what, Roger?
Well, I think there's a feeling that he hasn't, at a very difficult time for a nation that is war-drained, suffering very high unemployment and persistently high unemployment, that is anxious, that is angry in part. He hasn't found it in himself, it seems, to emote or find a vernacular, a language that people can identify with. And it's particularly shocking because during the campaign he seemed to have all that. And he hasn't been able to resolve problems economically. Far from bringing the country together, the country is perhaps more divided than ever. And on the international side, which I follow most closely, I think a lot of the hopes for a really new start, whether it was with Iran, in the Middle East, Israel, Palestine, again, he's fallen short. Now, clearly, the problems have been enormous, two wars, the economic meltdown, and clearly also many of the attacks on him have been scurrilous, but the disappointment is there.
You heard even nostalgia for the Bill Clinton years, the Bill Clinton way, in effect.
Oh, I think so, very much so. And I've asked myself whether Hillary Clinton might not have been stronger. I was, when I started supporting Barack Obama very early on in my columns, I was extremely concerned that the Bush-Clinton alternation end. I didn't think that was a good thing for the country. And I dismiss people who said that Obama was not experienced enough. Now I wonder, and clearly, what is this nostalgia about? It's about a politician who was not only intellectually brilliant, and clearly President Obama is highly intelligent, but also a man who enjoyed politics. If by politics we understand pressing the flesh, being out there, making deals, Clinton enjoyed that too. I think a lot of people have asked themselves how much this president actually enjoys politics, understood in that sense. So I think the real questions are over whether he had the experience for the job coming in, what his real convictions are. Clearly, he likes bringing people together, but where does he actually stand, say, on the Afghan war? Does he really believe in it? And, you know, whether or not he has the love of politics, as I just described it, because now, especially now, with the changes on the Hill, he's going to have to make deals if he's going to get anywhere.
Roger Cohen in London, please stand by. It's great to have you with us. William Galston joins us as well from Washington, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was deputy assistant to the president for domestic policy, that is, President Bill Clinton. He's also worked on campaigns for Al Gore, Walter Mondale, John Anderson. He's been thinking and writing about this president, President Barack Obama. Bill Galston, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here, Tom.
Begin to take us into your analysis. We'll look at the deals that the President Obama may need to make or where he may need to aim next. But when you look back on these first 2 years as president, boy, that's a pretty heavy tone of disenchantment we hear from Roger Cohen. What's going on?
Well, as Roger himself made clear, disenchantment is necessarily preceded by enchantment. And because I was never enchanted in the first place, supportive but not enchanted, I guess I'm not as disenchanted or disappointed as Roger, and I think speaking for a lot of other people, are. Many of the seeds of the problems that the president is now facing were sown during the campaign, and I'll get to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But first, I think we have to be fair in looking at the circumstances that this president faced when he took office.
I should say, I mean, they were as tough as it gets.
Tough as it gets. A couple of wars in a very unsettled condition. And worse than that, an economy that was not only plunging into a deep recession, but was doing so for reasons that we hadn't seen since the Great Depression. There was a genuine possibility of a national and global financial and economic collapse. We have to keep that in mind. And so I have some sympathy for the president when he says, as he has, that he had to make a whole lot of very difficult and potentially momentous decisions in very short order, and that he was relentlessly focused on understanding the problem, making those decisions, getting those decisions right, getting them done quickly enough to prevent the great ocean liner of the American economy from hitting an iceberg and sinking, which was a genuine possibility.
Are you saying that up against that challenge, this is as good as it could get in the last 2 years?
No, I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that before we proceed to the entirely valid criticisms, mm-hmm. and you know, anybody who knows my paper trail in the past 2 years knows that it's littered with them, mm-hmm. before we get there, mm-hmm. we have to focus on the problems this president confronted and what he got right. The undeniable fact is that a second Great Depression was a possibility and we're not in one. Now, in medical terms, what that means is that an economy that had suffered a grave life-threatening accident has been stabilized, no longer bleeding. The airwaves have been cleared. Critical but stable is the diagnosis now. But there needs to be a phase two, moving towards genuine recovery of health and function. And that's one of the president's great tasks over the next 2 years and probably longer than that.
Roger, you come, you're stationed there in London. You've been back in the U.S. and, you know, you've got some pretty gloomy observations about tone and reality in the U.S. in your recent columns. You see deeply wounded soldiers in airports and people out of work and people without great hope. Against all that, does it temper your assessment of this president, given the scale of what he and the country have been up against, or not?
Well, Yes, clearly the problems going in were huge, and cataclysm has been averted. But yes, the situation is still extremely critical. And I think, you know, for all the, as I said, scurrilous attacks of the Tea Party and the right of the Republican Party, they did latch on to something. You know, ever since I covered the wars in Bosnia, and you know, it was fascinating to me that Serbia at that time, the Serbs, while they were the chief perpetrators, could not get out of their heads that they were the victims. And nations have very strong notions, part rational, part irrational, of who or what they are. In France, clearly the idea of equality and fraternity is very important, at least as important as freedom. Now, in the United States, and I'm a naturalized American, came to the country from Europe, what has always struck me, and it appeals to me, mm-hmm. Perhaps not in its most extreme manifestations, but it does, is this notion of the United States as a nation of individualists, rugged individualists, suspicious of government, very suspicious of big government. And somewhere in the stimulus and the passage of health care, clearly President Obama went over some barrier there.
Roger Cohen, you were just saying there's a sense in which you think perhaps he's gone over some line. Let me just take that to Bill Galston, if I will. I mean, Bill, do you buy that? Did he go over a line on government scale and role, really? We've had, you know, very big government role in different times in the 20th century, certainly in this country.
Well, yes, I do, but I would put it slightly differently. I mentioned earlier that the president, I thought, had created some difficulties for himself during the 2008 campaign, and they rested, I think, on some fundamental misjudgments. First of all, he underestimated the depth and breadth of political polarization in the United States, the disagreement between the parties, and he thought it was going to be easier to bring red and blue America together into one America than most observers thought it would be. Second, and this begins to get to Roger's point, he overlooked the fact that as he was elected and as he took office, Americans' trust in their institutions of national government was at or near an all-time low. And that was bound to affect their willingness to accept new, large, striking steps by the federal government, particularly steps that expanded the size and scope of government and its cost. Third, and this is where I become critical of the president, the day he took office, the day he was elected, he had not one agenda but two agendas. He had the agenda of choice on which he'd run on, all of the good things that he wanted to do for the country. And then there was the agenda of necessity that events, starting with the financial collapse of mid-September, had forced upon him. And the defining question for the first 2 years of his presidency was, how would he balance these two agendas? Would the agenda of choice, all of the good forward-looking, forward-leaning things, be subordinated in any way to the agenda of necessity in the way that FDR subordinated the New Deal to Dr. Win the War once World War II was underway? The president made a fateful decision to pursue both simultaneously and full bore. And I think that decision turned out to be the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back, and the symbol of that is the year-long debate over a major expansion of government responsibility in the area of health care.
But Roger, okay, there's a big policy step. There's a decision on, you know, how much to do at one time, how many directions to go in at once. Some of that by choice, Bill Galston says, some by necessity. You raised right off the bat, though, this issue of whether President Obama needs to, I don't know, emote more, connect more, or be someone different. You raised the possibility that this, you know, Americans did not elect the man they thought they elected. So which is it, Roger?
Well, I think Tom, put very bluntly, you know, a lot of Americans are asking of this president, do you share my pain? Do you feel what I'm feeling? And they're not convinced. And I think that's partly some of what President Obama has said most recently. That remark, I don't remember it exactly, but to the effect that, gosh, it's a difficult time. People aren't being too scientific, you know, in the way they react to things. They're having crazy reactions, i.e. they're disliking me. It was a bit like during the campaign when he said some people found consolation in religion or words to that effect, which convey a kind of superiority. And the other thing is, yes, you know, who exactly is Barack Hussein Obama? Because of his name, because he's the first African-American president, because I think many Americans were looking in 2008 really for some kind of deliverance because the problems were so huge, he was seen as this transformational figure reaffirming American possibility, about to bring the country together, somebody coming in from the outside with a whole bunch of fresh ideas. Now I think people have become more aware that actually he came from the inside. He's an intellectual who went to private school in Hawaii, to Columbia, to Harvard. And he has a lot of ideas, much less experience and fewer convictions than ideas. And I think people are wondering, what in his gut does he believe? Where in his gut does he want to take this country? And, you know, as a logical consequence of that, are we ready to follow him? And I think they're still waiting for answers to that.
Bill, Roger puts that nicely, but that is a pretty stern critique right there. That borders on saying, you know, the guy's a fraud. You were there for Bill Clinton's time of, deep in the ditch politics after his first midterm. I mean, what about
it was.
What about the tenor of the critique of this president now, the tenor, the substance of it? How does it compare with what Clinton took? Is it, you know, for some reason, are we willing to go after President Obama in a more severe way? Or, you know, was it just as tough on Bill Clinton?
It was devastating. I mean, I was there. I'll never forget the staff meeting the morning after the November 1994 election, as the names of the defeated Democrats were read one by one. It was like the tolling of a bell, and it hit the president very hard. It was a disorienting experience. And the critique in some respects was very much the same, namely, he's not the man we thought we voted for. Bill Clinton listened very carefully to all of that. He didn't jump in one direction or the other immediately, but he took it on board, and he really wrestled with it. He tried to understand what had happened, why it had happened, what people were discontented with and about. And he regained his equilibrium and went on to be a very successful president, a very popular president the day he left office, and even more popular today. And those 8 years now are regarded as a period of pretty good government, wise fiscal management, vigorous economic growth, peace. We can argue about, you know, how enduring the peace of the 90s was. But the fundamental challenge facing Barack Obama today is just the same as the challenge facing Bill Clinton in November of 1994. Between now and the next State of the Union, this president has to look into himself, he has to reach into himself, he has to figure out what he wants the remainder of his presidency to be about. You know, what is the fundamental line of direction? Mm-hmm. What are the issues consistent with that? What is the political strategy consistent with that? And then he has to tell the country in clear, cogent, understandable, and unmistakable terms what he has decided. This presidency is by no means beyond repair. As a matter of fact, I think it's eminently repairable. And with a few smart decisions and some more work on the economy, I think the president is an odds-on favorite to be reelected and to succeed.
We'll look at what those smart decisions might look like. There's plenty of debate about that. I want to bring our listeners in here. Bill in Charleston, South Carolina. Bill, what do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a very interesting conversation that your guests are having, and I'm glad to be listening. But one thing I think that they're missing is that Mr. Obama appeared so strong in his campaign, and he had strong convictions and strong ideals that he was fighting for. And one thing that has affected him is the fact that in my state especially, these Tea Partiers, and by the way, parties are for Mad Hatters. I personally do not want people who think that civil rights legislation and the Americans with Disabilities Act are mistakes running my government. Having said that, these Tea Partiers mobilized the day President Obama was elected. They mobilized a campaign of hate and anger against taxation and spending. And while President Obama has not done anything he didn't promise us that he would do, these people have put out this message against his agenda that has really, I think, hurt our country.
Hate and anger, you say from the very beginning, and we will look at that. Bill, I appreciate your call. I mean, I look at our comments on the web at onpointradio.org, and there's quite a range. I mean, you got Jerry saying, thank God America is a center-right country. In this past election, we partially returned to sanity. In 2012, we will take back the White House. Then you've got Josh saying, you know, advice to Obama, listen to the left. Lead the way to the left. Love the left. The conservatives will never think you're anything but a socialist. And Larry says, Obama is either, one, weak, scared, and naive, or two, a corporatist in disguise. Take your pick. I pick corporatist in disguise. There's quite a range. Bill, let us hold that hate and anger piece for just a moment. Tim in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great topic, as always. My comment is that I'm a supporter of President Obama, as I have been and hope to be, hope to campaign for him again. But I'm a little frustrated with him. I think... your panelist nailed it on the head. He's not connecting with me emotionally. He's not getting out there and expressing what it is that he's trying to do. And I'm just a little frustrated with that.
Why do you think that is? I mean, here's a guy who, you know, he can talk till the cows come home. He's sharp as a tack, smart as can be. He connected with a very big majority of Americans in his campaign. They saw something that really and heard something that really moved them there. If it's less from the actual White House, why, Tim?
Well, that's a good point, Tom. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, he's only had two press conferences in 2 years. It just seems like he's not out front. He's not the point man. He was the point man in the campaign. He was the guy delineating all of his opinions and where he intended to go. But now that he's in the White House, he doesn't seem to be the point man. It seems that he's almost trying to dodge the grenades that are being hurled from the right.
Tim, I appreciate your call. Roger Cohen, how about it? Nick Kristof on across from you there on the editorial pages, op-ed page of the Times, says Obama needs to lose the cool and start sweating and slugging. There's the, you know, emote, sir, answer. Is that it, Roger?
Well, I think that caller really, you know, nailed it, the last caller. If that's how a supporter of Barack Obama is feeling, then something is wrong. And I've certainly heard from quite senior aides to the president. They're frustrated that they don't get FaceTime with him, that they're endlessly asked to prepare detailed memos on whatever subject it is, and, you know, detailed memos point 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, just like in an academic seminar, go up to the Oval Office, and eventually, you know, from on high, some response comes down. And look, people, whether they're aides to the president or Republicans in Congress, everybody's susceptible to the presidential charm if it is expressed. You know, 15 minutes with the president can go a long way. And if you transpose that to Europe, you know, one photo op with Obama might be worth 1,000 troops in Afghanistan. But he's been, for whatever reason, reluctant to do that. So I think, and he's an intelligent man. So I think, as William was saying, I don't know if it's eminently fixable. I think it's to some degree fixable if he takes that message on board. And I would say, you know, love the left and lose. You win elections in the American center, and if he goes that way, I think he's history. He has to look, the number one issue is jobs. To create jobs, you have to have the confidence of business, the business community, like it or not. He lost that. A lot of people were even asking if he's really a capitalist. That may seem strange, but it was out there. And I think he has to make sure he has the confidence of business leaders, because otherwise we're going to remain at close to 10% unemployment, and then again he loses.
So there's that connection with the business community, but this broader sense of the connection with the American people. He certainly made it in the campaign, Bill Galston. But I wonder, looking back, if part of what he was saying is he wanted to change things. Is he didn't want to be the emotive president. Perhaps he was saying he wanted to be a less emotional, more serious, more really engaged with actual issues president, not a kind of Jerry Springer president. I was struck by a piece of tape. This is president in India just last week, and he was speaking before the Indian Parliament, talking about Mahatma Gandhi, the independence leader there, with his very distinctive path, and saying, we need to be the change we seek. Maybe that's what he's trying to be. Let's listen.
Throughout my life, including my work as a young man on behalf of the urban poor, I've always found inspiration in the life of Gandhiji and his simple and profound lesson to be the change we seek in the world.
Be the change we seek. Bill Galston, maybe he's trying to model something different. Not Jerry Springer, but, sound, serious, at grips with the issues, less emotive.
Presidents have no choice but to be what they are. In the pitiless fishbowl of national politics in the White House, who you are will be apparent to all. And it is very, very rare for mature adults to get character transplants. It doesn't happen. There's an occasional Saul on the road to Damascus. But it's foolish for for anyone to expect that in the ordinary course of political events.
But does he really need that? He was poetry on the stump. Now prose in office. I know that saying. But still, we know he has the capacity to sort of be that, make the crowd stand up and roar if he wants to be.
Well, two things about that. First of all, I think the president is in the very early stages of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's famous stages of grief, and he's working through it. But among the first self-criticisms that he has leveled at himself is that he spent too much time as the legislator-in-chief and not enough time as the explainer and advocate-in-chief. I doubt very much that he is going to repeat that mistake in the second 2 years, but there's something deeper going on. Mm. And since you ran that clip, mm-hmm. let me read you and your listeners something that President Obama said in the middle of 2008, shortly after he defeated Hillary Clinton for the nomination. Here's what he said then, and I find this intensely revealing. He said, quote, "I am like a Rorschach test. Even if people find me disappointing, ultimately they might gain something." Now, as a candidate, you can be a Rorschach test if you're really good at your job. But as president, you can no longer be a Rorschach test. You have to be one thing or another. You may choose a path and fail. But if you don't choose a path, then you will surely fail. And as things now stand, the president has managed to disappoint both those of his 2008 supporters who thought he was going to be a liberal stalwart, that there would be a huge stimulus, a single-payer health care plan, Guantanamo shuttered, mm-hmm. don't ask, don't tell, abolished with the stroke of a pen, and the malefactors of great wealth thrown into jail one by one after being paraded before the American people. Mm. They're not very happy. On the other hand, the people who were for him, more moderate Democrats and independents, who took him at his word that he intended to create a new era of postpartisanship and cooperation, they're also disappointed. Now, in the next 3 months, he really has to decide on a clear way forward. The time for the Rorschach test presidency is over. He has to be one thing and not another. And this is a very important decision. It will define the next 2 years of his presidency. It will shape his reelection campaign and his chances for reelection. It will influence the course of the country. And I hope he's thinking that issue through, that strategic choice, with the clarity and open-mindedness that characterizes Mr. Obama at his best.
I want to get your thoughts on those paths where he might most effectively choose, and Rogers as well, and our listeners. But before we go to, you know, these next 2 years, I've just got to raise this piece. Eugene Robinson raised it in the Washington Post, columnist there last week. He wrote, "There's something distinctive about the nature and tone of the most vitriolic attacks on the president that I believe is distinctive," this is Eugene Robinson writing, "and difficult to explain without asking whether race is playing a role." And here's a Facebook comment from one of our listeners, Chad. He says, "It's hard to govern when nobody from the start wants to work with you, when they call him a socialist, communist, Muslim. I've never seen," Chad writes, "more disrespect from the minority party." And then he goes on to say, "All this name-calling and disrespect can only come from one thing, his color." Roger Cohn, what do you say to that answer?
I think it's true. I think in the innuendo about his not having been born in the U.S., about his supposedly being a Muslim when he's a Christian, there is this kind of visceral disrespect where just below the surface, or maybe not even below the surface, I certainly detect an element of racism. And that's what I meant, I guess, when I was talking about how scurrilous the attacks have been. So there's that. And so he's dealing with that, which is clearly makes things more difficult. But I think Bill's Rorschach test quote is that I'd never heard it before. It's absolutely staggering. And, you know, basically it's kind of a downer. It's sort of, even though you might not find me at all, you know, uplifting or anything, you know, it'll kind of get something out of being with me. Well, fine. I mean, that's great, you know, in a faculty classroom or something, but not for the leader of the free world. And I think there's really an issue there. And I agree with Bill that, you know, here in the UK, it's interesting. There are many parallels, post-September 2008 slump, tremendous budget deficits, individuals hugely overextended, trying to deleverage wherever they can. And, you know, say what you will about Prime Minister David Cameron's coalition government, there is no doubt where he's trying to head. He's slashing the state and he's cutting, and there are big protests. It ain't going to be easy. The cuts haven't really bitten yet, so who knows what lies in store next year. But, you know, I think people these days, they're bombarded with so much in their daily lives, opinions of every ilk. They do, in some strange way, they want leadership. They want clear leadership. And President Barack Obama, whether it's on Afghanistan with the kind of "hello, I must be going" plan, or domestically, the direction is not clear. And I totally agree with Bill that if he doesn't determine where he wants to head and make that clear to Americans, I think he's not going to make it in 2012.
So your headline, Roger, is "Get bold, Barack." Bold in what direction, then? How?
Well, I think that, as I said, I mean, I think he has to tack toward the Clintonian center. Enough of this, you know, attacks on fat cat banker. You know, by all means, prosecute. It's not right that everybody's just walked away from the Lehman Brothers collapse. I mean, that makes people angry. But I think he has to, as I said, he has to talk very seriously with, you know, the business community about means to stimulate confidence. And I think on the international arena, there has to be more toughness. Look at what's happened recently with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel just kind of walking all over the U.S. president, who held a White House ceremony for him, along with Abu Mazen, the Palestinian leader, early in September. And then Prime Minister Netanyahu just ignored what the president asked him to do, which was to extend the moratorium on settlement building in the West Bank, absolutely just walked all over him. And I think, you know, it's one small example of areas that the president has to adjust. I mean, this cannot be. The president of the United States has to be stronger, tougher, and clearer.
Or even today in South Korea, our U.S. ally, where the president goes, ready to sign that trade agreement, and no dice, no deal. He comes away without it. But there again, I mean, Bill Galston, the world is changing. The United States doesn't have the same stature it had not long ago. He doesn't have the biggest stick in history as an American president here. I mean, and he's got to deal with not just business, not just foreign potentates, but the Republicans. I mean, Roger Cohen's writing, you know, about John Boehner appealing to the American dreamland. He says Obama got on the wrong side of that dream, but it can also be a la-la land. This is a president, Bill, who's trying to, it would appear, be serious.
And I guess as a serious person myself, I'm less inclined to be critical of seriousness than some other people might be. I would also point out that Barack Obama is hardly the first American president to have stubbed his toe on the Israeli-Palestinian impasse. Having said that, I think that the president does need to get clear about a number of issues that are going to affect the fundamental course of the economy. And in a way, they've been teed up for him. First of all, a couple of major commissions are going to be delivering reports within the next 3 weeks mm-hmm. on the fiscal future of the United States. And more people are understanding that whatever course we adopt, we cannot stay the course because our current course is unsustainable and potentially ruinous for the country. If President Obama really wants to be the transformational president that I think he does want to be, then going down in history as the president who moved the United States from an unsustainable fiscal course to one that actually gives us hope for the future and maintains our potential for greatness as a country would be a massive accomplishment. But even short of that, there are some things that he can do that I think would really recapture the momentum politically and be very important substantively as well.
Are they in the Clintonian center or somewhere else?
I've done my share of writing on left, right, and center issues, mm-hmm. but let me just mention the two, and your listeners can determine for themselves whether they're left, right, or center. Number one, the least successful part of the administration's economic agenda has come in the area of housing. Their programs have been weak, small, and unimaginative.
Dealing with foreclosure and the whole crisis there.
From beginning to end, the administration has been behind the curve on housing. We are facing a wave of foreclosures in the next 2 years that will dwarf what we've seen in the past 2 years.
You want to write down everybody's mortgage interest rate?
There are lots of ideas that have been put on the table by housing experts that the administration either hasn't considered or has rejected. We don't have time to go into them now, but they're out there, and it's time for the administration to go back to the drawing board on housing. Secondly, candidate Obama had a very good idea for something called a National Infrastructure Bank, which would enable us to mobilize private capital on behalf of important public goods in which we've been underinvesting mm-hmm. for a generation. Mm-hmm. He dropped it for 18 months, returned to it in September. I think that ought to be front and center in the State of the Union because those are good jobs that can only be done in America. They cannot be outsourced.
Let's go to Linda in Franklin, Tennessee. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great
Hi.
Show, as always.
Thank you.
I'm a big supporter of Barack Obama. He inspired me with his campaign. Mm-hmm. He has lost me a little bit because I expected that he would come back out to us grassroots people with more conversation about what he was doing and what we could do. I kind of expected to be asked to do something mm-hmm. And was ready to, as I think so many people were. I've never seen anything quite like what we saw this election.
Yeah.
I think he's a smart man love hearing him talk after 8 years of Bush. And I think he's actually doing a lot. He's just not blowing his own horn.
If he came out to talk to you, Linda, Bill Galston says he may not have his story down, his narrative, the direction he's describing for the country. Do you think he's got it if he came out and sat in your backyard?
He seems to. I mean, he's done a little bit of that lately before this last, the midterm election.
Mm-hmm.
And he seemed to get, small groups of people fired up again. I think he's got it. I think he just needs to come and talk to us again. And I agree with the last comments about the housing. We are going to get smacked again. And, it's scary for those of us. I mean, my husband and I each work two jobs because he got laid off. And you look at all the bad stuff that's coming, and it scares the hell out of you.
Linda, I hope you hear and get what you need. And thanks for your call there. Let me get one more. Rebecca in Des Moines, Iowa. Rebecca, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just want to make two quick comments based on what Mr. Collins said at the beginning of the program. He said that Barack Obama must be able to make deals to get things done, and I don't understand how you can possibly believe that he could make deals and get things done with a new Republican Congress whose stated goal is to defeat President Obama in 2 years. And my second comment is that I was never really starry-eyed, but I did believe in Barack Obama, and my hesitation there was that I wasn't really sure about the white, older, white area of our country, and they have proven to not be able to accept the half-black man in developing this new Tea Party, this new Mad Hatter Tea Party, if you will. Those are my two comments. And I still do believe in Barack Obama, and I think that he has accomplished many of the things that he told us that he was going to do.
Rebecca, we've got it. I still believe, says Rebecca. And one more, Nick in Ottumwa, Iowa. Nick, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
First off, I think Barack Obama needs to take the gloves off a little bit more. And maybe not show more emotion, but behind closed doors, come out fighting. And then second, I think America's just a little too fickle. We've given a man 2 years to fix what George W. screwed up in 8 years. And we haven't looked at what he's succeeded at and what he's tried to succeed at and been stopped at.
Nick, we've got it. Our time is very short. Bill Galston, just quickly, can he make deals? Our caller reminds us, you've got Mitch McConnell saying, top goal, defeat this president. Can he make deals with the Republicans now in the House?
That remains to be seen, but he has a lot to gain from reaching out and convincing the American people that he is prepared to to make deals and to compromise. There was a very good survey that came out just a few days ago indicating that the overwhelming majority of Americans prefer politicians right now who are prepared to sit down and work things out rather than standing on principle, because people, I think, correctly believe that if you have opposing sides standing on principle, that nothing will get done. And not getting things done is not an acceptable option for the American people. So the president should make the first move. He should make generous offers. If the other side meets him halfway, that's great. If he doesn't, if they don't, he will pick up a lot of support from people who are looking for politicians who are willing to reach out to the other side. So it's a win-win proposition for him and for the country.
Roger, we've just got half a minute. What do you think? Has he still got the stuff, the potential to, I guess from your pretty gloomy view, turn this around?
I think he does, yeah, but I think it's going to be tough sledding, and we're going to have to see a different Barack Obama. I completely agree. If Republicans are just seen as blocking, filibustering, I mean, now they're the majority in the House. The American people's not stupid. If they see that Republican-induced paralysis, the president's going to benefit from that. And yes, he can make deals. Look at free trade. He could get the Colombia and Panama deals through, and with Republican help, and that I think would be helpful. So there's potential for him to fix this.
Well, there it is, an historic presidency at the midterm, and much to come. Roger Cohen with the New York Times, thank you so much. William Galston at the Brookings Institution, thank you, Bill. Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Mm-hmm.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.